This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Gemma Blythe, Moll Flanders, by Daniel Defoe, Section 5. I was reduced very low indeed, and was often delirious and light-headed. But nothing lay so near me as the fear that, when I was light-headed, I should say something or other to his prejudice. I was distressed in my mind also to see him, and so he was to see me, for he really loved me most passionately, but it could not be. There was not the least room to desire it on one side or other, or so much as to make it decent. It was near 5 weeks that I kept my bed, and though the violence of my fever abated in 3 weeks, yet it several times returned, and the physician said 2 or 3 times they could do no more for me, but that they must leave nature and the distemper to fight it out, only strengthening the first with cordials to maintain the struggle. After the end of 5 weeks I grew better, but was so weak, so altered, so melancholy, and recovered so slowly, that their physicians apprehended I should go into a consumption, and which vexed me most, they gave it as their opinion that my mind was oppressed, that something troubled me, and, in short, that I was in love. Upon this the whole house was set upon me to examine me, and to press me to tell whether I was in love or not, and with whom, but as I well might, I denied my being in love at all. They had on this occasion a squabble one day about me at table, that had like to have put the whole family in an uproar, and for some time did so. They happened to be all at table but the father. As for me, I was ill and in my chamber. At the beginning of the talk, which was just as they had finished their dinner, the old gentlewoman, who had sent me somewhat to eat, called her maid to go up and ask me if I would have any more. But the maid brought down word I had not eaten half what she had sent me already. "Alas," says the old lady, "that poor girl, I am afraid she will never be well." "Well," says the elder brother, "how should Mrs. Betty be well? They say she is in love." "I believe nothing of it," says the old gentlewoman. "I don't know," says the eldest sister, "what to say to it. They have made such a rout about her being so handsome and so charming, and I know not what. And that in her hearing, too. That hath turned the creature's head, I believe, and who knows what possessions may follow such doings. For my part, I don't know what to make of it." "Why, sister, you must acknowledge she is very handsome," says the elder brother. "Ah, and a great deal handsomer than you, sister," says Robin, "and that's your mortification." "Well, well, that is not the question," says his sister. "That girl is well enough, and she knows it well enough. She need not be told of it to make her vain." "We are not talking of her being vain," says the elder brother, "but of her being in love. It may be she is in love with herself. It seems my sisters think so." "I would she was in love with me," says Robin. "I'd quickly put her out of her pain." "What do you mean by that, son?" says the old lady. "How can you talk so?" "Why, madam," says Robin again, "very honestly, do you think I'd let the poor girl die for love? And of one that is near at hand to be had, too?" "Fie, brother," says the second sister, "how can you talk so? Would you take a creature that has not a grout in the world?" "Prithee, child," says Robin, "beauty's a portion, and good humour with it is a double portion. I wish thou hadst half her stock of both for thy portion, for there was her mouth stopped." "I find," says the eldest sister, "if Betty is not in love, my brother is. I wonder he has not broke his mind to Betty. I warrant she won't say no." "They that yield when they're asked," says Robin, "are one step before them that were never asked to yield, sister, and 2 steps before them that yield before they are asked. And that's an answer for you, sister." This fired the sister, and she flew into a passion and said things were come to that pass that it was time the wench, meaning me, was out of the family. And but that she was not fit to be turned out, she hoped her father and mother would consider of it as soon as she could be removed. Robin replied that was business for the master and mistress of the family, who were not to be taught by one that had so little judgment as his eldest sister. It ran up a great deal farther. The sister scolded, Robin rallied and bantered, but poor Betty lost ground by it extremely in the family. I heard of it, and I cried heartily, and the old lady came up to me, somebody having told her that I was so much concerned about it. I complained to her that it was very hard the doctor should pass such a censure upon me, for which they had no ground, and that it was still harder, considering the circumstances I was under in the family, that I hoped I had done nothing to lessen her esteem for me, or given any occasion for the bickering between her sons and daughters, and I had more need to think of a coffin than of being in love, and begged she would not let me suffer in her opinion for anybody's mistakes but my own. She was sensible of the justice of what I said, but told me, since there had been such a clamour among them, and that her younger son talked after such a rattling way as he did, she desired I would be so faithful to her as to answer her but one question sincerely. I told her I would, with all my heart, and with the utmost plainness and sincerity. Why, then, the question was, whether there was anything between her son Robert and me. I told her, with all the protestations of sincerity that I was able to make, and as I might well do, that there was not, nor ever had been. I told her that Mr. Robert had rattled and jested, as she knew it was his way, and that I took it always, as I supposed he meant it, to be a wild, airy way of discourse that had no signification in it, and again assured her that there was not the least tittle of what she understood by it between us, and that those who had suggested it had done me a great deal of wrong, and Mr. Robert no service at all. The old lady was fully satisfied, and kissed me, spoke cheerfully to me, and bid me take care of my health and want for nothing, and so took her leave. But when she came down, she found the brother and all his sisters together by the ears. They were angry, even to passion, at his upbraiding them with their being homely, and having never had any sweethearts, never having been asked the question, and their being so forward as almost to ask first. He rallied them upon the subject of Mrs. Betty. How pretty, how good-humoured, how she sung better than they did, and danced better, and how much handsomer she was. And in doing this he omitted no ill-natured thing that could vex them, and indeed pushed too hard upon them. The old lady came down in the height of it, and to put a stop it to, told them all the discourse she had had with me, and how I answered that there was nothing between Mr. Robert and I. "She's wrong there," says Robin, "for if there was not a great deal between us, we should be closer together than we are." I told her I loved her hugely, says he, "but I could never make the jade believe I was in earnest." "I do not know how you should," says his mother. "Nobody in their senses could believe you were in earnest, to talk so to a poor girl whose circumstances you know so well. But prithee, son," adds she, "since you tell me that you could not make her believe you were in earnest, what must we believe about it? For you rambled so in your discourse, that nobody knows whether you are in earnest or in jest. But as I find the girl, by your own confession, has answered truly, I wish you would do so too, and tell me seriously, so that I may depend upon it. Is there anything in it, or no? Are you in earnest, or no? Are you distracted, indeed, or are you not? 'Tis a weighty question, and I wish you would make us easy about it." "By my faith, madam," says Robin, "'tis in vain to mince the matter, or tell any more lies about it. I am in earnest, as much as a man as that's going to be hanged. If Mrs. Betty would say she loved me, and that she would marry me, I'd have her tomorrow morning fasting, and say to have and to hold, instead of eating my breakfast." "Well," says the mother, "then there's one son lost," and she said it in a very mournful tone, as one greatly concerned at it. "I hope not, madam," says Robin. "No man is lost when a good wife has found him." "Why, but child," says the old lady, "she is a beggar." "Why then, madam, she has the more need of charity," says Robin. "I'll take her off the hands of the parish, and she and I'll beg together." "It's bad jesting with such things," says the mother. "I don't jest, madam," says Robin. "We'll come and beg your pardon, madam, and your blessing, madam, and my father's." "This is all out of the way, son," says the mother. "If you are in earnest, you are undone." "I am afraid not," says he, "for I am really afraid she won't have me. After all, my sister's huffing and blustering, I believe I shall never be able to persuade her to it." "That's a fine tale, indeed. She is not so far out of her senses, neither. Mrs. Betty is no fool, says the younger sister. Do you think she has learned to say no any more than other people?
No, Mrs. Murthwaite, says Robin, Mrs. Betty's no fool. But Mrs. Betty may be engaged some other way, and what then?
Nay, says the eldest sister, we can say nothing to that. Who must it be to, then?
She is never out of the doors. It must be between you.
I have nothing to say to that, says Robin. I have been examined enough. There's my brother. If it must be between us, go to work with him. This stung the elder brother to the quick, and he concluded that Robin had discovered something. However, he kept himself from appearing disturbed.
Prithee, says he, don't go to shame your stories off upon me.
I tell you, I deal in no such ware. I have nothing to say to Mrs. Betty, nor to any of the Mrs. Bettys in the parish. And with that he rose up and brushed off.
No, says the eldest sister, I dare answer for my brother. He knows the world better.
Thus the discourse ended, but it left the elder brother quite confounded. He concluded his brother had made a full discovery, and he began to doubt whether I had been concerned in it or not. But with all his management he could not bring it about to get at me. At last he was so perplexed that he was quite desperate, and resolved he would come into my chamber and see me, whatever came of it. In order to do this, he contrived it so that one day after dinner, watching his eldest sister till he could see her go upstairs, he runs after her.
"Hark ye, sister," says he, "where is this sick woman? May not a body see her?"
"Yes," says the sister, "I believe you may. But let me go first a little, and I'll tell you." So she ran up to the door and gave me notice, and presently called to him again.
"Brother," says she, "you may come if you please."
So in he came, just in the same kind of rant.
"Well," says he at the door as he came in, "where is this sick body that's in love?
How do you do, Mrs. Betty? I would have got up out of my chair, but was so weak I could not for a good while." And he saw it, and his sister too, and she said, "Come, do not strive to stand up. My brother desires no ceremony, especially now you are so weak."
"No, no, Mrs. Betty, pray sit still," says he, and so sits himself down in a chair over against me, and appeared as if he were mighty merry.
He talked a lot of rambling stuff to his sister and to me, sometimes of one thing, sometimes of another, on purpose to amuse his sister, and every now and then would turn it upon the old story, directing it to me. "Poor Mrs. Betty," says he, "it is a sad thing to be in love. Why, it has reduced you sadly." At last I spoke a little. "I am glad to see you so merry, sir," says I, "but I think the doctor might have found something better to do than to make his game at his patients. If I had been ill, of no other distemper, I know the proverb too well to have let him come to me."
"What proverb?" says he.
"Oh, I remember it now. What?"
"Where love is the case, the doctor's an ass."
"Is not that it, Mrs. Betty?" I smiled and said nothing.
"Nay," says he, "I think the effect has proved it to be love, for it seems the doctor has been able to do you but little service. You mend very slowly, they say. I doubt there's somewhat in it."
"Mrs. Betty, I doubt you are sick of the incurables, and that is love."
I smiled and said,
"No, indeed, sir, that's none of my distemper." We had a deal of such discourse, and sometimes others, that signified as little. By and by, he asked me to sing them a song, at which I smiled and said my singing days were over. At last he asked if he should play upon his flute to me. His sister said she believed it would hurt me, and that my head could not bear it. I bowed and said, "No, it would not hurt me."
"And pray, madam," said I, "do not hinder it. I love the music of the flute very much."
Then his sister said, "Well, do then, brother." With that he pulled out the key of his closet.
"Dear sister," says he, "I am very lazy. Do step to my closet and fetch my flute. It lies in such a drawer," naming a place where he was sure it was not, that she might be a little while a-looking for it. As soon as she was gone, he related the whole story to me of the discourse his brother had about me, and of his pushing it at him, and his concern about it, which was the reason of his contriving this visit to me. I assured him I had never opened my mouth, either to his brother or to anybody else. I told him the dreadful exigence I was in, that my love to him and his offering to have me forget that affection and remove it to another had thrown me down, and that I had 1,000 times wished I might die rather than recover, and to have the same circumstances to struggle with as I had before, and that his backwardness to life had been the great reason of the slowness of my recovering. I added that I foresaw that as soon as I was well I must quit the family, and that as for marrying his brother, I abhorred the thoughts of it, after what had been my case with him, and that he might depend upon it I would never see his brother again upon that subject, that if he would break all his vows and oaths and engagements with me, be that between his conscience and his honour and himself, but he should never be able to say that I, whom he had persuaded to call myself his wife, and who had given him the liberty to use me as a wife, was not as faithful to him as a wife ought to be, whatever he might be to me. He was going to reply, and had said that he was sorry I could not be persuaded, and was a-going to say more, but he heard his sister a-coming, and so did I, and yet I forced out these few words as a reply, that I could never be persuaded to love one brother and marry another. He shook his head and said, "Then I am ruined," meaning himself. In that moment his sister entered the room, and told him she could not find the flute. "Well," says he merrily, "this laziness won't do." So he gets up and goes himself to go to look for it, but comes back without it too. Not but that he could have found it, but because his mind was a little disturbed, and he had no mind to play. And besides, the errand he sent his sister on was answered another way, for he only wanted an opportunity to speak to me, which he gained, though not much to his satisfaction. I had, however, a great deal of satisfaction in having spoken my mind to him with freedom, and with such an honest plainness as I have related. And though it did not at all work the way I desired, that is to say, to oblige the person to me the more, yet it took him from all possibility of quitting me, but by a downright breach of honour, and giving up all the faith of a gentleman to me, which he had so often engaged by, never to abandon me, but to make me his wife as soon as he came to his estate. It was not many weeks after this, before I was about the house again, and began to grow well, but I continued melancholy, silent, dull, and retired, which amazed the whole family except he that knew the reason of it. Yet it was a great while before he took any notice of it, and I, as backward to speak as he, carried respectfully to him, but never offered to speak a word to him that was particular of any kind whatsoever. And this continued for 16 or 17 weeks, so that, as I expected every day to be dismissed the family, on account of what distaste they had taken another way, in which I had no guilt, so I expected to hear no more of this gentleman, after all his solemn vows and protestations, but to be ruined and abandoned. At last I broke the way myself in the family for my removing, for being talking seriously with the old lady one day about my own circumstances in the world, and how my distemper had left a heaviness upon my spirits, that I was not the same thing I was before, the old lady said. "I am afraid, Betty, what I have said to you about my son has had some influence upon you, and that you are melancholy on his account. Pray, will you let me know how the matter stands with you both, if it may not be improper? For as for Robin, he does nothing but rally and banter when I speak of it to him." "Why, truly, madam," said I, "that matter stands as I wish it did not, and I shall be very sincere with you in it, whatever befalls me for it. Mr. Robert has several times proposed marriage to me, which is what I had no reason to expect, my poor circumstances considered. But I have always resisted him, and that, perhaps, in terms more positive than became me, considering the regard that I ought to have for every branch of your family. But," said I, "madam, I could never so far forget my obligation to you and all your house, to offer to consent to a thing which I know must needs be disobliging to you." And this I have made my argument to him, and have positively told him that I would never entertain a thought of that kind, unless I had your consent, and his father's also, to whom I was bound by so many invincible obligations. "And is this possible, Mrs. Betty?" says the old lady. "Then you have been much juster to us than we have been to you, for we have all looked upon you as a kind of snare to my son, and I had a proposal to make to you for your removing, for fear of it. But I had not yet mentioned it to you, because I thought you were not thorough well, and I was afraid of grieving you too much, lest it should throw you down again. For we have all the respect for you still, though not so much as to have it be the ruin of my son. But if it be as you say, we have all wronged you very much." "As to the truth of what I say, madam," said I, "refer you to your son himself. If he will do me any justice, he must tell you the story just as I have told it." Away goes the old lady to her daughters and tells them the whole story just as I had told it her, and they were surprised at it, you may be sure, as I believe they would be. One said she could never have thought it, another said Robin was a fool, a third said she would not believe a word of it, and she would warrant that Robin would tell the story another way. But the old gentlewoman, who was resolved to go to the bottom of it before I could have the least opportunity of acquainting her son with what had passed, resolved, too, that she would talk with her son immediately, and to that purpose sent for him. For he was gone but to a lawyer's house in the town, upon some petty business of his own, and upon her sending, he returned immediately. Upon his coming up to them, for they were all still together, "Sit down, Robin," says the old lady, "I must have some talk with you." "With all my heart, madam," says Robin, looking very merry. "I hope it is about a good wife, for I am at a great loss in that affair." "How can that be?" says his mother. "Did not you say you resolved to have Mrs. Betty?" "Eh, madam," says Robin, "but there is one as forbid the banns." "Forbid the banns," says his mother, "who can that be?" "Even Mrs. Betty herself," says Robin. "How so?" says his mother. "Have you asked her the question, then?" "Yes, indeed, madam," says Robin. "I have attacked her in form 5 times since she was sick, and I am beaten off. The jade is so stout she won't capitulate, nor yield upon any terms, except such as I cannot effectually grant." "Explain yourself," says the mother, "for I am surprised. I do not understand you. I hope you are not in earnest." "Why, madam," says he, "the case is plain enough upon me. It explains itself." "She won't have me," she says. "Is not that plain enough?" "I think 'tis plain, and pretty rough, too." "Well, but," says the mother, "you talk of conditions that you cannot grant. What does she want? A settlement? Her jointure ought to be according to her portion. But what fortune does she bring you?" "Nay, as to fortune," says Robin, "she is rich enough. I am satisfied in that point. But 'tis I that am not able to come up to her terms, and she is positive she will not have me without." Here the sisters put in. "Madam," says the second sister, "'tis impossible to be serious with him. He will never give a direct answer to anything. You had better let him alone, and talk no more of it to him. You know how to dispose of her out of his way, if you thought there was anything in it." Robin was a little warmed with his sister's rudeness, but he was even with her, and yet with good manners, too. "There are 2 sorts of people, madam," says he, turning to his mother, "that there is no contending with. That is, a wise body and a fool. 'Tis a little odd I should engage with both of them together." The younger sister then put in, "We must be fools indeed," says she, "in my brother's opinion, that he should think we can believe he has seriously asked Mrs. Betty to marry him, and that she has refused him." "Answer, and answer not, say Solomon," replied her brother. "When your brother had said to your mother that he had asked her no less than 5 times, and that it was so, that she positively denied him, methinks the younger sister need not question the truth of it when her mother did not." "My mother, you see, did not understand it," says the second sister. "There's some difference," says Robin, "between desiring me to explain it and telling me she did not believe it." "Well, but son," says the old lady, "if you are disposed to let us into the mystery of it, what were these hard conditions?" "Yes, madam," says Robin, "I have done it before now, if the teasers here had not worried me by way of interruption. The conditions are that I bring my father and you to consent to it, and without that she protests she will never see me more upon that head. And to these conditions, as I said, I suppose I shall never be able to grant. I hope my warm sisters will be answered now, and blush a little. If not, I have no more to say till I hear further." This answer was surprising to them all, though less to the mother, because of what I had said to her. As to the daughters, they stood mute a great while, but the mother said with some passion, "Well, I had heard this before, but I could not believe it. But if it is so, then we have all done Betty wrong, and she had behaved better than I ever expected." "Nay," says the elder sister, "if it be so, she has acted handsomely indeed." "I confess," says the mother, "it was none of her fault, if he was fool enough to take a fancy to her. But to give such an answer to him shows more respect to your father and me than I can tell how to express. I shall value the girl the better for it, as long as I know her." "But I shall not," says Robin, "unless you will give your consent." "I'll consider of that a while," says the mother. "I assure you, if there were not some other objections in the way, this conduct of hers would go a great way to bring me to consent." "I wish it would go quite through it," says Robin. "If you had as much thought about making me easy as you have about making me rich, you would soon consent to it." "Why, Robin," says the mother again, "are you really in earnest? Would you so fain have her as you pretend?" "Really, madam," says Robin, "I think 'tis hard you should question me upon that head, after all I have said." "I won't say that I will have her. How can I resolve that point when you see I cannot have her without your consent? Besides, I am not bound to marry at all. But this I will say, I am in earnest in, that I will never have anybody else if I can help it. So you may determine for me, Betty or nobody in the world. And the question which of the two shall be in your breast to decide, madam, provided only that my good-humoured sisters here may have no vote in it." All this was dreadful to me, for the mother began to yield, and Robin pressed her home on it. On the other hand, she advised with the eldest son, and he used all the arguments in the world to persuade her to consent, alleging his brother's passionate love for me and my generous regard to the family. In refusing my own advantages upon such a nice point of honour, and a thousand such things. And as to the father, he was a man in a hurry of public affairs and getting money, seldom at home, thoughtful of the main chance, but left all those things to his wife. You may easily believe that when the plot was thus, as they thought, broke out, and that everyone thought they knew how things were carried, it was not so difficult or so dangerous for the elder brother, whom nobody suspected of anything, to have a freer access to me than before. Nay, the mother, which was just as he wished, proposed it to him to talk with Mrs. Betty. "For it may be, son," said she, "you may see farther into the thing than I, and see if you think she has been so positive as Robin says she has been, or no." This was as well as he could wish, and he, as it were, yielding to talk with me at his mother's request, she brought me to him into her own chamber, told me her son had some business with me at her request, and desired me to be very sincere with him, and then she left us together, and he went and shut the door after her. He came back to me and took me in his arms and kissed me very tenderly, but told me he had a long discourse to hold with me, and it was not come to that crisis that I should make myself happy or miserable as long as I lived, that the thing was now gone so far that if I could not comply with his desire, we would both be ruined. Then he told the whole story between Robin, as he called him, and his mother and sisters and himself, as it is above. "And now, dear child," says he, "consider what it will be to marry a gentleman of a good family, in good circumstances, and with the consent of the whole house, and to enjoy all that the world can give you, and what, on the other hand, to be sunk into the dark circumstances of a woman that has lost her reputation, and that though I shall be a private friend to you while I live, Yet, as I shall be suspected always, so you will be afraid to see me, and I shall be afraid to own you." He gave me no time to reply, but went on with me thus: "What has happened between us, child, so long as we both agree to do so, may be buried and forgotten. I shall always be your sincere friend, without any inclination to nearer intimacy, when you become my sister, and we shall have all the honest part of conversation, without any reproaches between us of having done amiss. I beg of you to consider it, and to not stand in the way of your own safety and prosperity, and to satisfy you that I am sincere," added he, "I here offer you £500 in money, to make you some amends for the freedoms I have taken with you, which we shall look upon as some of the follies of our lives, which 'tis hoped we may repent of." He spoke this in so much more moving terms than it is possible for me to express, and with so much greater force of argument than I can repeat, that I only recommend it to those who read the story to suppose that as he held me above an hour and a half in that discourse, so he answered all my objections and fortified his discourse with all the arguments that human wit and art could devise. I cannot say, however, that anything he said made impression enough upon me so as to give me any thought of the matter, till he told me at last very plainly that if I refused, he was sorry to add that he could never go on with me in that station as we stood before, that though he loved me as well as ever, and that I was as agreeable to him as ever, yet sense of virtue had not so far forsaken him as to suffer him to lie with a woman that his brother courted to make his wife. And if he took his leave of me with a denial in this affair, whatever he might do for me in the point of support, grounded on his first engagement of maintaining me, yet he would not have me be surprised that he was obliged to tell me he could not allow himself to see me any more. And that, indeed, I could not expect it of him. I received this last part with some token of surprise and disorder, and had much ado to avoid sinking down, for indeed I loved him to an extravagance not easy to imagine. But he perceived my disorder. He entreated me to consider seriously of it, assured me that it was the only way to preserve our mutual affection, that in this station we might love as friends, with the utmost passion, and with the love of relation untainted, free from our just reproaches, and free from other people's suspicions, that he should ever acknowledge his happiness owing to me, that he would be debtor to me as long as he lived, and would be paying that debt as long as he had breath. Thus he wrought me up, in short, to a kind of hesitation in the matter, having the dangers on one side represented in lively figures, and indeed, heightened by my imagination of being turned out to the wide world, a mere cast-off whore, for it was no less, and perhaps exposed as such, with little to provide for myself, with no friend, no acquaintance in the whole world out of that town, and there I could not pretend to stay. All this terrified me to the last degree, and he took care upon all occasions to lay it home to me in the worst colours that it could be possible to be drawn in. On the other hand, he failed not to set forth the easy, prosperous life which I was going to live. He answered all that I could object from affection and from former engagements, with telling me the necessity that was before us of taking other measures now, and as to his promises of marriage, the nature of things, he said, had put an end to that by the probability of my being his brother's wife before the time to which his promises all referred. Thus, in a word, I may say, he reasoned me out of my reason, he conquered all my arguments, and I began to see a danger that I was in, which I had not considered of before, and that was of being dropped by both of them and left alone in the world to shift for myself. This, and his persuasion, at length prevailed with me to consent, though with so much reluctance that it was easy to see I should go to church like a bear to the stake. I had some little apprehensions about me, too, lest my new spouse, who, by the way, I had not the least affection for, should be skilful enough to challenge me on another account, upon our first coming to bed together,
and whether he did it with design or not, I know not, but his elder brother took care to make him very much fuddled before he went to bed, so that I had the satisfaction of a drunken bedfellow the first night. How he did it, I know not, but I concluded that he certainly contrived it, that his brother might be able to make no judgment of the difference between a maid and a married woman. Nor did he ever entertain any notions of it, or disturb his thoughts about it. I should go back a little here to where I left off. The elder brother, having thus managed me, his next business was to manage his mother, and he never left till he had brought her to acquiesce and be passive in the thing, even without acquainting the father other than by post letters, so that she consented to our marrying privately, and leaving her to manage the father afterwards. Then he cajoled with his brother, and persuaded him what service he had done him, and how he had brought his mother to consent, which, though true, was not indeed done to serve him, but to serve himself. But thus diligently did he cheat him, and had the thanks of a faithful friend, for shifting off his whore into his brother's arms for a wife. So certainly does interest banish all manner of affection, and so naturally do men give up honour and justice, humanity, and even Christianity, to secure themselves. I must now come back to Brother Robin, as we always called him, who, having got his mother's consent, as above, came big with the news to me, and told me the whole story of it, with a sincerity so visible, that I must confess it grieved me that I must be the instrument to abuse so honest a gentleman. But there was no remedy. He would have me, and I was not obliged to tell him I was his brother's whore, though I had no other way to put him off. So I came gradually into it, to his satisfaction, and behold, we were married. Modesty forbids me to reveal the secrets of the marriage bed, but nothing could have happened more suitable to my circumstances than that, as above. My husband was so fuddled when he came to bed that he could not remember in the morning whether he had had any conversation with me or no, and I was obliged to tell him he had, though in reality he had not, that I might be sure he could make to inquiry about anything else. It concerns the story in hand very little to enter into the further particulars of the family, or of myself, for the 5 years that I lived with this husband, only to observe that I had 2 children by him, and that at the end of 5 years he died. He had been really a very good husband to me, and we lived very agreeably together, but as he had not received much from them, and had in the little time he lived acquired no great matters, so my circumstances were not great, nor was I much mended by the match. Indeed, I had preserved the elder brother's bonds to me, to pay £500, which he offered me for my consent to marry his brother, and this, with what I had saved of the money he formerly gave me, about as much more by my husband, left me a widow with about £1,200 in my pocket. My 2 children were, indeed, taken happily off my hands by my husband's father and mother, and that, by the way, was all they got by Mrs. Betty. I confess I was not suitably affected with the loss of my husband, nor indeed can I say that I ever loved him as I ought to have done, or was as proportionable to the good usage I had from him. For he was a tender, kind, good-humoured man as any woman could desire, but his brother being so always in my sight, at least while we were in the country, was a continual snare to me. And I never was in bed with my husband, but I wished myself in the arms of his brother. And though his brother never offered me the least kindness that way after our marriage, but carried it just as a brother ought to do, yet it was impossible for me to do so to him. In short, I committed adultery and incest with him every day in my desires, which, without doubt, was as effectually criminal in the nature of the guilt as if I had actually done it. Before my husband died, his elder brother was married, and we, being then removed to London, were written to by the old lady to come and be at the wedding. My husband went, but I pretended indisposition, and that I could not possibly travel. So I stayed behind, for in short I could not bear the sight of his being given to another woman, though I knew I was never to have him myself. I was now, as above, left loose to the world, and being still young and handsome, as everybody said of me, and I assure you I thought myself so, and with a tolerable fortune in my pocket, I put no small value upon myself. I was courted by several very considerable tradesmen, and particularly very warmly by one, a linen draper, at whose house, after my husband's death, I took a lodging, his sister being my acquaintance. Here I had all the liberty and all the opportunity to be gay and appear in company that I could desire, my landlord's sister being one of the maddest, gayest things alive, and not so much mistress of her virtue as I thought at first she had been. She brought me into a world of wild company, and even brought home several persons, such as she liked well enough to gratify, to see her pretty widow, so she was pleased to call me, and that name I got in a little time in public. Now, as fame and fools make an assembly, I was here wonderfully caressed, had abundance of admirers, and such as called themselves lovers, but I found not one fair proposal among them. As for their common design, that I understood too well to be drawn into any more snares of that kind. The case was altered with me. I had money in my pocket, and had nothing to say to them. I had been tricked once by that cheat called love, but the game was over. I was resolved now to be married or nothing, and to be well married or not at all. End of section 5.